tell you what we had in mind to talk about, and then Joel Torsens is going to make that kind of kickoff statement, and then we really hope that everyone will have a chance to express himself. There's a small enough number here that maybe we can get a real conversation going and get a lot of different opinions and maybe resolve some questions. More than a week ago, some of you may remember that Arndt Halvorsen, a professor at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, was holding a session in the morning on communication, and Arndt felt that the key to communicating the Christian gospel in the 20th century, especially now in the middle of the century after the experiences we've had historically speaking, was the doctrine of the crucifixion. And while I'm sure I wouldn't want to be held responsible for everything Arndt said, the way that it came across to me anyway was that the crucifixion, the kind of thing that Christ went through, the kind of self-giving and free sacrifice that the crucifixion represents for us, that this crucifixion, in a sense, set up a kind of style of life. And you remember we had a forum last week on Christian lifestyle in which we kind of moved in and out of this question again. But at the end of Arndt Halvorsen's morning presentation, in which he had argued that the crucifixion was the basis for a real style of living, a real lifestyle, Joel Torstensen asked what it seemed to me to be a very piercing question. And it's a question that I was kind of, I guess I thought it was piercing because it was sort of simmering in the back of my mind all the while too during Arndt's discussion. What Joel asked was simply this: how are we going to harmonize the crucifixion, the self-giving kind of denial of oneself and one's basic, so to say, natural, or to use a biblical term, fleshly inclinations and desires? How are we going to harmonize that, which runs so counter to many of the things that we feel and want, with the everyday ethic that pertains in the work world, the ethic of competition, the ethic that in some sense is a kind of refined Darwinism, the idea that in the business world, the best man gets to the top, and if you're president of General Motors and your picture's on the cover of Time magazine, presumably you have survived in a pretty tough world. And I would suppose that you have survived, many of us would, by being a man who looks out for himself and who is a little bit sharper and not unwilling to apply that sharpness when it comes to other people. Now, you remember that, and then Joel's question, and maybe Joel will put it for himself again, but just to set this off, I say, Joel's question was, we talk about the Christian ethic of self-sacrifice and self-giving, but what does that say to the man who is in the real world, the world that's down at the bottom of the lake and at the end of the boat trip, where the ethic of self-sacrifice and of turning the other cheek and going a second mile and giving up your coat when somebody asks, or your coat and your sport coat when somebody wants only your coat, well, where does that ethic fit in, the ethic of the crucifixion and self-giving, with the ethic that prevails in the modern world, one wants to say American business world, but I'm sure it's true everywhere. And then you remember that last week, at the end of the week, Martin Marty suggested that this is one of the real, really difficult questions that Christianity has hardly begun to grapple with, the development of a so-called work ethic, an ethic whereby the values that prevail in the workaday world have something to do and some intricate and integral relationship with the Christian gospel. I suppose it's all summarized for me in the dilemma of a student that I had a couple years ago. I was talking about how in the modern 20th century world, in comparison with the medieval world, we have divorced the areas of business and religion. And she came up to me afterwards and said, it's all very well to be holy and righteous, she said, but my dad's a car dealer. And she said, he's keeping a Presbyterian church in our town going, and one of the ways he keeps it going is by turning speedometers back on used cars. And she said, if he got self-righteous, the Presbyterian would get hungry, or at least the pastor would, because she wasn't being arrogant about it. She was being very honest, I felt. Well, to start this discussion off with that as a background, Joel and I thought that he might make some comments about how we got to the situation we're in. In other words, to put it bluntly and and I hope not totally unpleasantly, the history of the situation. And after Joel makes this statement, then we hope that you will jump in on this thing and that we'll be able to evolve some kind of conversation or some kind of internal development to it here.
Well, I suppose there are at least two perspectives on the development of the separation of ethics from work that has played an important role in development of this in our time. One is the interpretation of Max Weber in his little book on the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. It's so long as I read this book, so I'm just going to pick out some of the salient motifs that he develops. He argues that the Protestant, in separating, in emphasizing individual responsibility and for his faith, became very anxious about this. And then the doctrine of being saved by grace came in to save him from this awesome responsibility of his own salvation. And while you would think that would kind of, in one sense, free him from anxiety, Max Weber suggests that it really didn't free him from this anxiety, because he couldn't help but speculate about whether or not he really is saved by grace. And he began to look for signs of being saved by grace, if he weren't doing very well, if he was failing in his economic, in his work world, or if he was failing in his relationships, or if he was ill, he came to think that, probably God wasn't very pleased with him, which may be a sign that he was really going to hell. And so he became increasingly constrained to work and achieve in order to prove to himself, if not to anybody else, that he was destined for salvation. Well, this set up a kind of a psychic drive for compulsive view of work. And of course, as he worked, he produced, and as he produced, he came to possess more things. And yet he couldn't, as a good Christian, waste this production in wine, women, and song. And so, since he couldn't spend it, he accumulated capital. And as he accumulated capital, then the next concern came upon him. He mustn't squander. He has to become a good steward. So he began to develop an emphasis upon work and thrift, and then stewardship, and in the very process, you develop what he calls the fundamental spirit of capitalism. Partly, I think Weber was just playing around with this hypothesis. But this is how capitalism got started. I think the argument has been challenged by many historians, arguing that capitalism did emerge in other places where Catholics were flourishing rather than Protestants. But in any case, he identified these elements, this close proximity between the sense of personal responsibility and hard work and thrift and good stewardship, all the ingredients which tended to give birth to this entrepreneurial society that we have, you know. And Richard Tawney's book, Religion and the Rise of Capitalism, takes a somewhat different historical interpretation, but ends up with the same kind of judgment about the kinds of values that became important for Protestants in the New World. He says that when Calvin developed his theology in Switzerland, He emphasized both the ethics of community as well as the ethics of personal responsibility. But when the Calvinist movement flourished in England, there was a great spurt of trade and commerce, and the people who were attracted to the Calvinist theological emphasis in England were more interested in the personal ethic than the community ethic. So, to oversimplify Tawney's book, what he fundamentally says, it seems to me, is that the Calvinists in England, the Puritans in England, sloughed off the community ethics and ended with a personality ethic or private ethic, the privatization of ethics. And then this got transported into this country with the exploitation of the natural resources and the development of this this nation. The importance of hard work to transform the natural resources into products for consumption and commerce became terribly important. Well, in any case, the outcome of this whole evolutionary process was that ethics became separated from both community and the responsibility of human relations generally, and primarily became a very private affair. If you carry this all the way, now in the early days, it seems to me, when the family farm and the family store, there was a kind of ethic of work that related to the sense of a family sharing together the work as well as the proceeds and the in celebrating both the productivity and the consumption of the produce of agricultural labor, of husbandry and stewardship of the land and all this sort of business. But more and more, farming became a business rather than a market-oriented business, rather than a production for use. And this became, and as the evolution of our society from family stores and family farms and family enterprises generally to corporate enterprise, we transferred the individual ethics into the corporation. And so you had that period of the robber barons, and no matter, and when the people who owned the mines, then they became the benevolent father, and the ethics was primarily one ethics of production rather than the ethics of sharing and the ethics of distribution. As a very simple and very brief outline of where we are, and this was driven home to me when one of my colleagues in the at the college was asked to give a lecture for a group of pastors on the relationship between ethics and economics, and he prepared the statement, and he asked me to look at it, and I thought it was generally a very good statement, but I said, raised one question. There is nothing said here about the ethics of the corporation, and he shook his head and said, well, that's right, of course. And here I've just had a year ago, he'd had a course at the University of Chicago where they spent a good deal of time talking about the rise of the modern corporation. And it had never dawned on him, you know, that a corporation should be concerned about ethics. The market takes care of the price of goods. Another thing comes to my mind when I took a job in southeastern Minnesota shortly after the war. I was doing some work for a cooperative organization, and I needed a car very badly. You know, there was a shortage of automobiles. And the new cars were just barely coming in. And I went to one of the automobile dealers and said, well, I do a lot of driving. I have an old jalopy here, an old Studebaker, one of these small Studebaker Chanceys, I believe. And it was falling to pieces. And I said, I really need a new car. And I wondered if he could make a deal. Yes, he said, I'd be glad to. And I asked him, what kind of a deal? I said, your car is probably worth about $700. I'll take the $700. Then I'll take the market price and $700 more. And I said, well, now, that seems like a rather expensive car. And he really became irate. And he said, well, you don't understand. A car is worth as much as you can get for it. Now, you see, that's the market orientation. Eric Fromm talks about this in his book, Man for Himself. He describes the evolution from production-oriented point of view, which is characteristic of the farmer, to a market-oriented point of view, which is characteristic of the salesman. And we had a very fine little glimpse of the death of the salesman last night. And then from here, we move into the market, to the orientation of consumption, consumer-oriented. In all of this, there's a kind of Richard Tawney said, an automatic substitute. The market becomes the automatic substitute for any ethics. So it seems to me that it's not strange that people don't ask the ethical question. Mm-hmm. How much is an acre worth? Land is worth as much as you can get for it. And the market mechanism, I suppose Adam Smith lurks behind the scene in this thing a bit. Maybe the unseen hand of God, but I don't think anybody thinks about the unseen hand of God anymore. One just simply says, well, what's the market price today? Mm. Adam Smith at least had some kind of a notion that God does not leave his economy all alone. Now, somebody else might want to, if Dr. Bainton were here, he could give us a brilliant lecture on the spur of the moment on this evolution of ethics and its relationship to the Protestant Reformation. Anybody want to add to this or raise some questions about it?
I've got a question. I mean, to me, it looks like we're discussing two different things here. One was how Protestants got to be such hard workers, and, supposedly, and why. And another one is what they did when they got all this money.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's right.
Is that those two questions?
Yes, I think so.
But it is the same question. I that thought occurred to me too, Don. But then as I was sitting here listening to Joel and thinking about it, it is really the same question, you see, because what we're interested in is how did it come to be. How did it come to be that, and this is not meant as an accusation, because as Joel and I were talking about this tonight, we both want to make it plain that we're not in any different pickle than the rest of you, and if we are, it's you that are supporting us. I mean, we have the fun of getting to teach and as it were, sort of looking the other way while this goes on in some sense or other, if that's the best that could be said for a person that's teaching, or I suppose a pastor or something else. But the point is this, you see, how did it come to be that, as Martin Marty said the other night, no one ever, as Joel says, no one ever, supposes that the private ethics that Christianity enjoins upon the individual has anything to do with the way you relate to the other guys in your car agency or your customers, you see. How did it come to be that a man, a Christian, probably will feel in perfect conscience that he should get as much for a used car as the market will bear, rather than asking himself, what is it really worth, you see, which is what medieval Christians, for example, act. And the point is that Protestantism engendered in people the ethic of hard work, because hard work was one way of showing that God was favoring you. You know, you really couldn't know who was saved, according to the Reformers, but the fact that you were prospering was one indication, you know. And the ethic of hard work was born, and that kind of went off in its own direction, if you follow me. And in the other direction, you get the continuation of this Sermon on the Mount kind of ethic, the ethic of self-giving, self-crucifixion. And the question is then, what does a Christian do when he suddenly sees that he's got two totally different life systems here? One way of behaving as a part of the corporate system, say, or part of our society generally, you know, and another way of thinking about his personal relationship. In other words, you know, the question is, why should a Christian try to buy a car as cheaply as he can or try to sell the car as dearly as he can? See, there was a time when most Christians thought that's what a Christian isn't supposed to do. A Christian's supposed to say to himself, now this man is my brother, you know, and he wants my car, and we should sit down together and arrive at a fair price, what the car is really worth, you see. But like Joel says, the only way we really decide is, what can I get for it? And if you add, like this gal said, she said, nobody bargained harder with my dad than somebody else who belonged to our church, you know. Because he figures we belong to the same church, you ought to sell me that car cheaper. is there any way that these two fit together? And I guess what we really want to know is, I mean, especially you people that are, I mean, we're all in the everyday workaday world, but how do we understand ourselves? I mean, this is what we're interested in. Especially in view of the fact that a lot of kids are saying baloney to it all, eh? It's all baloney. And they're dropping out, and even as authoritative an organ as Time magazine says, the hippies are not that different, you know, than some of the things they talk about are things that Christianity has stood for. Absence of materialism, treating other people fairly on a non, you know, money basis and this kind of thing.
That's what we're also grappling with here.
But I think, some of you know, I worked for General Motors, and when I joined them over 18 years ago, I don't feel I joined the devil's workshop.
No.
The thing is a handy handle, because it's really around here. I think that part of the problem is just addressed yourself, is that we work in a, we're operating in a different economy than those Middle Ages, or even more recent, and that we had no measure of the value of an acre. So you got together with the guy, and they were doing the same thing. This guy was thinking my acre was worth $1,000, the other guy thinks it was worth $100, and they haggled, and eventually got to it. The barter system was haggling. I'll throw in a couple more handfuls of grain, and we'll get together. In our modern economy, we don't have this head-on, face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball, negotiation, mm-hmm. and the marketplace establishes the value of the house. Mm-hmm. You tell me what the value of that acre is, and I'll pay you that for it. But you can't tell me, I'll make it easier, instead of your hypothetical acre, how much is your house worth? Your house is worth exactly what I'll pay you for it.
Yeah. Well, that's the point I'm making. I'm not trying to say that this is wicked. I just say this is the transformation, and whether it's wicked or not, that's kind of our question, I guess.
We've got a connotation that the capitalist system we live under has undermined our ethics, or made an ethical businessman an impossibility. The fact that the Presbyterian car dealer is trying to get as much for his car as he can, and that the fellow person is trying to get for as little as he can, I think is part and parcel of our capitalist system. And indeed, is the only way we have in our system to establish a price for that car.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get what Richard Tawney says: the market becomes the automatic substitute for ethical considerations.
Maybe ethics of the marketplace.
But the ethics of the marketplace, if you manipulate, you have a managed price system, for example.
Then you're getting into the.
Yeah, that you see
the here. Then I think we're getting into two ethical questions.
Yeah, and I guess.
Vice president that went to jail for 12 days or something like that. That's getting into an ethical question.
Well, what about turning the speedometers back?
Against the law in California, can't drive myself.
I could say
the opposite example and really hang us up. You used an example of a car dealer right after the war, which was not a normal time.
I could have told the other part of that story. you probably would like that. The General Motors man, for some reason or other, he gave me a very good deal without any of that extra
$700. How many people who go out to buy a car right now, the $3,000 car is selling for $2,400 this time of year? How many of you are going to go out and say that either that's really a $3,000 car, here's $3,000? Mm-hmm. I don't want to hang the dealer.
No, I didn't mean to imply at all that the dealer is being hung. I mean, that's why I quote this gal in my class. The point is, he's part of a system, and the guy that buys the car is as much a part of that system, you know, as the guy that sells it, and they bear the weight for it, whether for good or bad. I mean,
let's shift the arena. Let's take the academic marketplace. We know something about that one, and I think that's every bit as ugly. I think anybody who, you know, gets a...
I'm not willing to use that word.
Oh, okay. But it's every bit as troublesome. You know, well, I think if you listen out to what I'm going to say about the ugliness of this particular case, if you read Kaplow's book, The Academic Marketplace, PhD, you know, the person who's got his PhD, whether it's in any field, if he really wants to get ahead in his profession, he knows that there are all kinds of ways to do this. Well, the first thing you do, you know, when you write your thesis, is to case your committee, and in particular your advisor, and you write, you know, what must be written, with all kinds of reservations that you'd like to put in there if you were really going to be honest. And you pick the topic that you know he's interested in, and he's writing a book, and he likes the research that you do. It's going to fit him. And so you play the game. It's a game-playing device from the beginning to the end. There's more to it than this. But then when you... And then you try to weasel out some journal articles out of that, and you use your advisor who has contacts with the publisher of the journal, you know, in your field. And this advisor writes to the journal and says, why don't you ask so-and-so for an article on such a topic? And of course, the article happens to be radio, and it gets in the journal. And then his name gets all over the field. And then, of course, everybody wants to hire him. And you know, the higgling and haggling of the academic marketplace, the upmanship is, am I exaggerating, Tom? The upmanship in the academic arena is one of the most, one of the most difficult, serious difficulties that all church colleges are faced with, is that the church, operates under the premise that a man should be really delighted to serve the church as a teacher. And he should be glad to get enough so that he can keep his body and soul together and a trip once in a while and a sabbatical. But you very jolly well know that if you really want to get into the marketplace and make your place, you leave the church-sponsored institution and get into the university. And you got all kinds of problems. Now, I think we can't escape Eric Fromm's assessment that we are living in a market-oriented society, and we do say that the market sets the values of things, and it's not based on it may not be based on ethical. It's a sort of an automatic, self-regulating phenomenon. And so you raise the question, well, does a Christian have anything to say? I was chairman of a church and economic life committee in Minneapolis and St. Paul for a few years. And we tried to set up a weekend conference between labor leaders and business leaders and church leaders. And when we looked, for some top-flight industrial and business leaders of the city, and I remember talking to one of them. He said, what has religion got to do with economics? He didn't see any point in a conference like that at all. See, so that in a sense, he was really saying that the ethical questions are really not germane to the economic life. Now, Thomas Jefferson would never have allowed that, nor would Martin Luther, who said in his blunt way to let the market establish the price would be to open all the doors and windows to hell.
Usury.
Yes,
or even interest.
In this sense, you see, he was more. He was a Catholic. He was Catholic.
Don't we have to ask one more question, though? You said the values are shaped by the market mechanism. But then don't we have to ask the question, well, what shapes the value of the marketing system? And can't we at least say that at least partly there's an ethical body behind an ethical patterns operating behind us and determining how the market system is and is not to operate through the legal measures that we have provided through legislation in the Congress, setting up, you know, what are fair business practices or not, you know, setting up a better business bureau, setting up a fair labor standards commission, and the various, Sherman Antitrust Act and whatnot. In a sense, don't these measures almost say, you know, not only is it illegal, but somehow, you know, at least a lot of the motivations behind, a lot of attachments, like, it certainly was economic advantages, but also, I think, there's a lot of ethical principles behind it.
But you wouldn't say that the businessman or the industrialist were particularly clamoring for regulation.
I think he...
Did I miss your point, I wonder?
No. I mean, you've asked a good question, Bob. But I think that once there is, once there is the law, that they will operate within that framework, and those are the principles, on which the market system operates. The principles, the legal principles, and that's why you have, for instance, all these papers going before, for instance, the SEC. One company will get another company the same. You violated, a certain practice covered by the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission. Well, you'll both say, not only is that illegal, what you did, you took unfair advantage of me in the competitive marketing process. So that the rules, that have been set up to regulate the capitalistic system, I think, can also be seen as the ethical principles behind it. And that a violation of
isn't it better to say that these are the ethical principles? There are efforts made through government to establish some ethical principles to influence and to moderate and put restraints on the market system.
I think you've gotten down to the basic question. It's been said, perhaps rightly, that the free enterprise system operates on the principle, necessarily operates on the principle of selfishness, and the Christian method is unselfishness.
Mm-hmm.
And directs out to, and these, all these laws, the gospel according to nature, as we call it, is an attempt to modify the selfish motive that left with free reign would make chaos out of the system. And I think this might be our basic question.
I think that is exactly to the point.
Yeah.
And that's what I hope we can talk about. We have an economic system which restrains competition, but the very restraint of competition is in the interest of selfishness too, in a sense. Okay? Now against that, you've got an ethical system in the New Testament, and what are we going to do with it? Which suggests that the purpose of your life, isn't to seek your own your own ends. The purpose of your life is self-giving, free giving of yourself. I mean, and I'm asking, how do you put that's what we're asking. How do you put those two together, or don't you? Maybe you don't.
I don't want to dominate you.
No. We don't want to dominate you either.
I system that is what works provides more things to more people. And I can, I don't have to give this guy the coat off my back. The system will provide a coat for him. And therefore, I'm a fan of capitalism that does this better.
It reminds me, we get into the, you know, it seems to me if you took, you could argue, couldn't you, that if Christian ethics really is applied to the economy go belly up.
Everybody go broke.
And that you get the irony that we get more things for more people if we don't try to, you know, don't try to be good, so to speak. Somehow, here again get to this automatic business. The unintended consequences of everybody pursuing his own well-being and his own selfish interest is that everybody gets more.
But then, if we're all satisfied with this, I don't want to be the devil's advocate, and I won't be if I quote Christ. I'm just left asking, what was he talking about? You follow me? What are all those words about there? About when somebody hits you on one side, turn the other cheek, you know? I mean, what are we going to do with those? And I don't pretend I know the answer. But I really feel we ought to confront those words. I mean, in the course of our being, in the time I've been here, I've been impressed again and again with the knowledge that people manifest of what Christ thought and said and wanted us to do. And here are some of the simplest, plainest words that he ever uttered, unambiguous, it seems, anyway. And what do we do with them? I mean, don't they even bug us? Well, these are people that think like you do are some of the people I'd like to hear from here.
I don't feel like you do.
Go ahead. Repeat your song.
Well, if you manage it well, you reinvest it, you see, as a good steward, and then it accumulates, and then the acquisitiveness comes in, and you see, the Protestant ethic gets you launched into the acquisitive system, and once you get launched, then it's just like getting on the launching pad, and then the... Yes, but supposing, now let's just to defend the argument, not to defend the argument, but to defend the people who believed in saving. You know, you can read the letters of Andrew Carnegie and the statements of John D. Rockefeller, and they would say that if we gave the money away, we wouldn't, you would never have the Standard Oil Company and the coordination and development of the oil industry. You wouldn't have the, you know, the steel industry developing. You know, what would happen in America would have been, you know, would have been safe for the Indians. And secured for the Indians. I missed that. Yes, but I think you'd have to say that, Rockefeller, in fact, said this, that if I should pay the workers more money, and Carnegie said it too, they would squander it for liquor on Saturday night and spend it on their kids, and it really wouldn't develop capital. And how in the world do you develop capital for the vast investments that it takes to launch any kind of industry, whether it's an automobile industry or the building of railroads? And it seems to me you could argue, I think, that it was the acquisitive impulse of the robber barons of the 19th century that really built this country. And it couldn't have happened without it. Without it.
In line with what she's saying and what you said before about the ethics and perhaps a collective stewardship in a nation, I guess I was taught to believe there is something real sacred about free enterprise, and I got to be way along in life before I even stopped to ask, you know, what makes it sacred? Ever questions, you know? And then I think that I observed that there's a tendency on the part of everyone to believe that we've got absolute free enterprise, you know. And I think what ethic often comes in, and what the law that you were talking about comes in, the law is always after the thing. Somebody takes advantage of the free enterprise system, and the law comes along and says, it rarely anticipates somebody, going against what you would call public ethics, and I would call Christian ethics insofar as the Christian ethic has established the culture under which we operate, so that, you know, right now we got a deal, where's this doctor, made $169,000 last year out of Medicare, and everyone says, you know, this is maybe ethical. No, maybe it is, maybe it is. I'm not questioning whether it is. It seems to me like quite a lot of money in 1 year off Medicare for one doctor. I don't think we have too many of them making that much off of Medicare. But we get a thing going, or we say, hey, look at these corporations. It looks like under the profit motive, they're cheating a little bit. And they are going in cahoots on what they're going to charge for the price of aluminum or something like that. And right away, you know, go after it. And the law says, this is bad stewardship, collective stewardship. This goes against the ethic that under which our nation is established and so forth. Now, I'm not saying it does any of it perfectly, but I think it does it to an extent.
Doesn't the market have to operate within the ethical system that people would, you know, in which it's working? In other words, to be most effective in the long run, for instance, that car dealer that turns his money, that turns his speedometers back to cheat his customers, as soon as this becomes generally known, he is no longer an effective businessman because people no longer buy cars because he is a cheat. You know, and so that in a sense, you know, that the person who stays clean and his business practices and in his salesmanship levels with his customers, so that they know that his, you know, his money, his word is as good as his money, or his money is as good as his word. But isn't that...
You buy a car in Chicago and you find out that's the way it works there.
Everybody turns the dollars back, so you go in there with the idea, well, this guy turns the dollar back, I got to really outjust him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, how it went. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if this isn't a more naive interpretation of what really goes, that the person who really is meticulously honest in every detail really prospers.
Yeah.
I think we have to face the real possibility that the man who, you know, really cheats with wit and brilliance,
Bobby Baker,
does pretty well, you know. Yes, of course. Let me give you an illustration of that. I sold another car, another old Studebaker. Seems like I'm caught up with little old cars, but those were the days when I was going to graduate school, the car was falling to pieces, and I was going to sell it. I bought another car, which is a little bit better. And then I asked my station man, I said, what can I sell this car for? What's a reasonable price? And I knew what was wrong with it. And I says, I want to tell the person who buys it, if he buys it, he'll have to fix this car. Don't be a damn fool. Nobody else does. Nobody else is. You know. And that's a part of it. He says, nobody bothers to tell that. You let him discover it for himself. But I think, I refuse to accept that, and I did tell the person about it, but I'm not going to try to make the virtue out of my life. I think I... She was saying that we're not a Christian. But I think you're assuming that the market price now operates sort of pristinely, you know, without the intervention of human sin. And I guess I find I have a difficult time separating the market operation from conscious decision-making of people who are in the positions of power to establish price. And I think we have to get away from the automobile dealer, and we have to get away to the large corporate system. And the whole business of mass media and the creation of consumer wants and the massive misinterpretation of the value of things. And that we sell a car not only in terms of what it'll do for you to get you from one place to another, but what it'll do for you in status and all the kinds of... It seems to me the whole advertising industry is organized around the premise that original sin will work freely if you let it. And we will respond to all the cues of temptation, to status-seeking and personal advancement. Well, and so then don't we end up saying then, that's why I come to the conclusion that I cannot accept the assessment that capitalistic society is fundamentally a Christian society. I think the tension between a capitalist society and a Christian society, Christianity, is terribly acute, and we may say that they're irreconcilable, in the same way that a communist society and a Christian society, a totalitarian society and a Christian society may be irreconcilable. Where does that leave one, you know? I guess I'd say we just have to learn to live with some kind of a compromised life and be saved by grace. Yes.
I'd like to respond to what you said about more things for more people. I don't think that, well, I mean, you put this as if this was the ethic. I don't think that's quite the same as the Christian ethic of
I see myself as something else. I'm trying to rationalize capitalism. How can I be a Christian and stand up for something that is based on a type of selfishness?
Mm-hmm.
In order for free competition to work, you've got to be competition. In order for competition to work, you've got to have a degree of selfishness. How can I describe such a system? By saying that it is the system that will produce the most and will indeed put a coat on a man's back, instead of having you take it off my back and put it on me.
Yeah, I think this would be somewhat acceptable in Christian standards if it was the same set that he brought up just a minute ago about advertising. I mean, and how we're kind of seduced into wanting more and more and more and more things. I mean, things. So that we're sort of that our society is just overwhelmed with things, you know.
I think we're getting to that. I think that I have enough trouble with trying to find the truth about the advertising industry, which I think...
I'm not asking...
I think the question of things is a question that's been raised here, and that's the question, and that's one of stewardship. What we do after we get our paycheck, how many cars we have, and how many televisions, and so on. And I think that's a different question worthy of discussion, too.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's the system where we're really working to give everyone what they needed, then I don't think we'd have a problem. I mean, it's a system we're working to help all the people and the ones who are starving. But it's not really. It's the way it works is it just gives the people who have the money more and more stuff, rather than really giving to the people who need it.
I don't think that's an indictment of the capitalist system or free enterprise system or any system. I just think that's another actual question of proper stewardship.
You mean, when the people get the money, they should give it to care or something like this, rather than buy
the third car.
But isn't it more complex than that? I think we, may have prefaced this by saying I don't think any of us can say we're outside of this. It's our system we're talking about, and I'm not going to try to say that just because you happen to work for General Motors, you are particularly involved in more wickedness. And I think we're all involved in it. It's our system we're talking about. But it seems to me that if we should do a sort of social accounting that Michael Harrington talks about. The production of mass production of automobiles has created, and the advertising of automobiles has created an interest in all of us that we all must have our own car, and we've created a kind of an automobile culture, and that means we've got to build highways and freeways, and that means that all kinds of things are let loose in this. The unintended consequences, I guess, what I'm talking about, and while people, 40 million people don't have enough food, or teachers in the city schools can't get enough salaries, we are all motivated to buy yet another car and yet another car, and we also have worked in obsolescence, I suppose, so the car or refrigerator shouldn't last too long, so that after you use it a few years, 2-3 years, maybe you trade for a new one, and then we get a junk piles and poor stewardship of the natural resources. It seems to me that the capitalistic system really has turned out to be a terribly exploitive one. And I'm not so sure that a communist system would be better. I'm not trying to make it, but I'm just trying to think about our system now.
Well, certainly it's true that the biblical communism, as expressed in Deuteronomy and throughout the Old Testament, is far more Marxist than the capitalist, because it definitely says from each of these tables to each of these.
Mm-hmm.
And
I suppose it's kind of interesting to contemplate the fact that Karl Marx was nurtured out of a Jewish family. I think he was baptized, wasn't he baptized
as a
Lutheran?
Young man, his father.
But his father was a good acclimated businessman, I believe, who thought the best way to get ahead was to...
He was a civil servant, that's the reason.
Civil service.
I think that, and I don't want to beat this point over the head, but if we confess, you see, that we must make our peace with the world, and as has been suggested by this gentleman and by Joel and by a number of other people, if there does seem to be some kind of tension, then I'm curious what we make of biblical ethics. And I'm especially curious because, like all of you, you know, I've been around Mennonites or something like this. We lived for a year in Ontario, where there were people who wanted to take the biblical ethics so seriously that they went and lived separately so they could do it, eh? And they had as little traffic with capitalistic Canadian, which is the same if they could get as rich as we are, they would, and I hope I'm not offending any Canadians here, you know, which operates in the same premises as American society does. I mean, is it true then that if you really want to take it seriously, the best thing to do is to go get a hold of the northwest corner of a county someplace? Marty was mentioning when he was here the Duke of Boers and these other sects that have finally just pulled out and become separate so that they can put this ethic into practice. I mean, what does the ethic mean to the rest of us that don't? Or do we simply live in the tension? I mean, I know what I'm doing. I'm simply living in the tension. But I fear that I make an easy peace with it. Do you follow me here? If somebody were out there tonight and he were hungry, you know darn well we would feed him till he burst, right? There's a world that's hungry. I don't want to be too preachy here, but it's true, isn't it? And if doesn't the parable, I mean, don't the parable of the Good Samaritan, the sermon, doesn't any of this stuff have any meaning to that? And if so, what does it mean? You know? That's what I'm asking. And this gentleman puts it as succinctly as anybody. There's a system, the system upon which we operate, and I'm part and parcel of it, is based on selfishness. And then there seems to be another system which is enjoined upon us, and it's selflessness. And we claim to be adherents of that other system, don't we? And we live in the one. Now, I mean, I would like to hear us. I don't want to force this on you. But what do we do with this? I mean, how do we understand our lives? Do they fit together at all? Or do we, well, what do we do? Or don't we?
I think we do what you said. We live in tension, but not enough.
Well, then, you know, what bugs me about that, sir, is that then you get, you know, Eric Fromm saying, that's the trouble with Christians. You know, the better Christians they are, the more they whip themselves, you know.